Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Bonsoir. To us, we are now looking forward to our first speaker, a philosopher and sociologist in Paris, carrying out research in the field of cognitive materialism. You are also writing about cinema and video production, and you have now published your text about the factory of indebted people, also in German. And ladies and gentlemen, you can buy this book here at the bookstore in the House of World Cultures. Now, you have been focusing on the impact of debt and being indebted, and you are particularly interested in the purpose of the infinite. And I'm looking forward to your presentation. Now, over to you, Mr. Lazzarato.
Bonsoir.
Good evening, everybody. I'd like to thank everyone who's invited me, and I have to apologize because I'm not terribly well this evening. So I'll try nonetheless to do my best and present my text to you. The text I'm going to read to you is dedicated to Gilles Deleuze. Gilles Deleuze wrote this phrase in 1990. Man is no longer man enclosed, but man in debt. This simple phrase, which you can find in one article that he wrote, was something which really hit me at the time. And that's why I chose to work upon debt. And if you're interested in the notion of debt and notions circling around that, you'll find the most striking and forceful notions in the work of Gilles Deleuze. I wanted to start on the basis of three statements by three scholars, a philosopher, an anthropologist, and an economist. And all three of them make an affirmation which is full of sense, or indeed perhaps full of nonsense, relating to money, exchanges, and the market, which have freed us from the servitude of personal relationships, with debt serving as the paradigm here. Liberal and neoliberal freedom, which is produced by the market and money, is freedom from debt. If we are free, it's because we are no longer and will never again be indebted. Now, these scholars are not necessarily liberals. And let's start, as is only right, by the economist, because the economy is at the origin and the model of all social sciences. Where does the economic liberty of people come from, the liberty, the freedom of the market, from the possibility that they have to free themselves from the debts which they have contracted vis-à-vis feudal powers, personal debts that they had from vassal to overlord or from serf to master? The abstraction of debt, which is rendered possible by the generalization of money, frees people from these personal links. Debt becomes transferable, can circulate. That is the very essence of the monetary economy. Capitalism invented an egalitarian system where more and more people owe nothing to anyone. The market is therefore an extraordinary system of abstraction, of transferability, and of settlement or payment of debts. Money frees us from links of personal subordination because debts expressed in money make relationships impersonal, anonymous, and transferable. Let's remember those terms, anonymous and transferable, because as we'll see, these have played a significant role in the so-called subprime debt crisis. Let's continue with another academic, a scholar, an anthropologist this time. Anthropologists, when they study archaic societies, are well aware that historically speaking, debt preceded exchanges by quite some time. So here comes the anthropologist. One might wonder whether the enormous movement within modern economy is not actually the last and most radical way to be done with gods, to be done with gifts, to be done with debt. Economy frees us not only from economic debt, but also from the original debt, from primordial debt, from life debt towards the gods and supernatural forces. Let's move on to a philosopher who is a genuine apologist for the market and for money. He gives a definition that is very fine-tuned of the modern individual as a sovereign, freed individual, free of all links, of all dependencies. In a non-monetary society, I only have credits vis-a-vis people who are close to me, to whom I have rendered a free service. However, when I provide a mercantile service, and therefore a monetary service, the one who benefits from this is, by making a payment, immediately freed from all debt vis-a-vis me. The money he gives me does constitute a claim, a debt that is owed to me. But vis-a-vis another who is entirely anonymous and abstract, nothing links me, him to me, in terms of gratitude, recognition of debt. So we move away from all psychological and moral weight, and the exchange can take off. It can be rational, efficient, and free. This was written quite recently, after 2000, so not just in economic terms, but in religious terms and moral and psychological terms, we're free. These three scholars express a counterintuitive truth, because on the contrary, we have the impression that debt, rather than vanishing, is absolutely everywhere. We feel that discourses on private debt, sovereign debt, reimbursement of debt, the guiltiness of debtors is something which has bedeviled our existence for the past 6 years. Just think of the countries of the South, Italy, Spain, Greece, for example. Before we look at the theoretical reasons why these scholars come to such a counterintuitive conclusion, I'd like to focus, first of all, on universities in the U.S., where at least two of these scholars teach. Why am I focusing on American universities? Because this temple of the conservation and production of Western knowledge is a paradigm of the financial enterprise and the debt economy in a number of different respects. First of all, it represents an ideal realization of the relationship between creditor and debtor and the predatory approach that the first has on the second. First of all, the American student perfectly embodies the situation of the indebted man, expressing in a paradigmatic fashion for society as a whole the conditions of subjectivation of the economy of debt. The New York branch of the Fed drew up a report, a three-monthly report, on the level of debt of students in America. On the 31st of March of this year, the total of sums lent to and that were borrowed to fund studies were $904 billion, $30 billion more than just 3 months earlier. To give you an idea of the order of magnitude of this sum, it is tantamount to more than half of public debt of Italy and France, countries with more than 60 million inhabitants. For a much smaller debt, Europe and the IMF have not hesitated for one moment in destroying a country like Greece. It's the sixth year of recession there. Now they're attacking Spain, Italy, and Portugal. With similar or even lower figures, these bodies impose austerity, sacrifices, unemployment, poverty, and recession on millions of people. In the United States, two-thirds of all graduates are in debt. The number of people who've taken on debt to complete their studies is now 37 million, and they have increasingly limited prospects to reimburse this debt. This tendency is demonstrated in the Federal Reserve study. 32% of debtors are over 40, and 5% are even over 60 years of age. People take on debt before entering the labor market, and they're indebted for life. One household in five, 19% indeed, had to pay back a student loan in the U.S. in 2010. The Fed recalls that student loans have become the second most significant debt factor for American households in 2010. They're even more important than debts incurred via credit cards. To my mind, then, the situation of American universities is a really striking example of what happens in neoliberal societies and the way in which a service such as that of training and education, that kind of service, that kind of social right, is replaced by a loan, by debt. Now, there are quotes that say that debt, or rather, the economy frees us from debt. Money frees us from debt. We've got 60% debtors and 40% who are rich, who are the children of debtors. So the question is really how the social sciences are doing and how low they have fallen under the neoliberal society. Now, we can continue with this metaphor because, in fact, the debt of American students works exactly like subprime debt. What happened then with the American banks? They turned this debt into a title or a security. Now, these securities were put on the market and could be bought and sold once again over one-third of these debts are securitized, these student debts, and that's what constituted the subprime bubble. The logic is exactly the same. It's a different order of magnitude, but the same logic is imposed upon. And loans are made to everybody, even to the poor, and in the process, they're impoverished financially, and they're not able to pay up at the end of the day. Furthermore, those scholars that I cited earlier focused on money, how it frees us from debt, is anonymous and transferable. It renders debt anonymous and transferable. But this very transferability is striking. The fact that debts have become anonymous is exactly at the root of the crisis in Europe. What happened with the securitization of subprime securities? Debt was transferred to the banks because they purchased this as securities. They saw a new market opening up where they could speculate. And banks were full of these junk securities. So securitization is one of the things which brought about this problem. It gave rise to this crisis. That was the transferability. And anonymity was also a problem. The banks didn't know either how many of these junk securities they had and where they were. So abstraction, anonymity, and transferability doesn't free us from debt at all. It's what gives rise in the very first place to debt. Furthermore, debt introduces a new kind of relationship, a new kind of political control over the general populace. And I'm going to be continuing with the example of students and look at what's happening currently in Europe. Deleuze said this already when he said that man is no longer man enclosed, but man in debt, man in hospitals, man in factory, the disciplinarian society of Foucault. There's a kind of control exercised on the indebted man and on man as a prison man who's enclosed. Well, there are different forms of control. I'm going to very briefly run through this, looking at American students by way of example. Debt as a power relationship between the creditor and debtor implies a particular subjectivation of the debtor. The power of control and of constraint doesn't come from the exterior, as in discipline-based societies, but it comes from within the debtor subject himself. Student is his own boss, his own controller, one of the toposes of the enclosed man. The worker is controlled within a closed space which corresponds to the walls of the factory for a limited time, 8 hours of work. It depends how long. If you go to China, it's maybe a bit longer. And by people and dispositives external to him and readily recognizable. In order to exist, it can draw not just on individual resources, but also on the labor collective and the solidarities therein. Control by means of the debt dispositive functions in a very different way. It's not in a closed space. And the time over which the control is exerted is not limited either. Space and time here are those of life itself. If you look at these students, for example, the time period over which they pay back the debt is 20 to 30 years. And during this period, it's the debtor who has to organize his or her life on the basis of the reimbursement of debt. The question of time, of duration, is at the heart of debt, not the working hours, not the working time, but a full lifetime. And debt creates a bridge between the present and the future, anticipating and exercising preemptive force upon the future. Debt has is a technique. Through current debt, we try to determine and control future behavior. Debt is an individualization technique. It's a technique destroying all solidarity, all the possibility of collective action. The indebted person is alone, responsible all on their own. They can't count on solidarity except from their family, who runs the risk of ending up in debt themselves. That's what happens in the US. Families get into debt to pay for the studies of their children. They feel guilty. They feel a sense of shame. The only point in which American students started to enter into a kind of coming out was during the Occupy Wall Street movement, the lugubrious Freudian theory of the superego, which commands and imposes guilt upon the ego, could be reformulated without exaggerating too much through creditor-debtor relations. The superego creditor here imposes conditions upon the ego, which is the debtor, so that, for example, blackmail, bad conscience, guilt, all function within the interior of the subject. The enemy, the guilty person, is within the subjectivity. Debt produces subjectivity, which is well suited to producing human capital and the entrepreneur of the self. Students don't just need to view themselves as capital, which they have to make the most of through their own investments, the debts they take on to study, and they're forced to behave as if they were businesses in and of themselves. There's all these rules that apply. For example, that you have to learn accounting provisions, principles of organization of a firm. This is all imposed on people who've never set foot in a company. And the students have all the disadvantages you can possibly imagine, and no advantage from being transformed into an individual enterprise, a one-person enterprise. They're forced to behave like an enterprise, but it's not possible for them to go bankrupt. They're moved actually afoot to introduce individual bankruptcy provisions, as is the case elsewhere, for example, in France. So we have not the idea of debt being cancelled by money. We all have this notion of creditor-debtor in our pocket, so to speak. I mean, how can you say that this is the case when you buy something every single day with a credit card? And we can refer to students again to talk about another way in which Americans behave in general and their relationship to credit and debt. In 2008, 84% of American students had at least one credit card, compared with only 76% in 2004. But what's more surprising is that students on average have 4.6 credit cards. Now, the reason for this crazy situation is that costs of studying have gone sky high. So the Americans, like the English, carry their credit in their pockets. The creditor-debtor relationship is inscribed into the chip of their credit card. Every purchase is a financial act, mobilizing credit and debt. So rather than vanishing, debt accompanies us into the marvelous world of the consumer society and becomes an infinite debt. A quote from somebody involved with credit cards. While consumer credits were based on explicit applications, the card system makes credit automatic. The inversion of initiative is exemplary here. With cards, the credit relationship is already set up beforehand. It's no longer, you just have to use the card. We're no longer people who ask for a loan. We accept cards, the system of payment by cards, therefore establishes a structure of permanent debt. So the situation we're currently experiencing has structural roots. It's not because the Greeks are consuming and not working, or the Spanish are consuming beyond their means, or anything like that. This world of neoliberal accumulation is works in this fashion. You can see a very clear example of this if you look at American universities. Who pays for the universities, the structures, the studies? Well, it's the students themselves, rather than society as a whole, paying for this. That brings me to the end of this first section. I'd like to quote Aristotle, who says that money and knowledge have nothing in common. Money and knowledge have nothing in common. Finance, moving over and beyond this affirmation, has established an arbitrary measure for knowledge, but it's normative and efficient. The debts people have taken on and the deadlines are the price for having access to science and to truth. That's what we find in Western society. I'd like to move on now to the next point in more theoretical terms.
Well, the scholars say that money actually frees us from debt. And now allow me to turn to the theoretical reasons which actually lead our scholars to such improbable and unlikely conclusions. We'll only talk about the issue of money. Money is finally and only a debt. Is that it? Here I will turn myself to Nietzsche. In fact, it's the contrary of what the scholars are saying. The debt is, in fact, it's something that's not final and unique. What is the question? The debt in contemporary capitalism, is it an infinite debt? Money, to which we attribute the possibility to free us from debt. It depends on what type of money you refer to. So the type of money that we ascribe this ability to free us is, in fact, the trading money, the one that is used to pay, to measure, to hoard money for exchange. And therefore, it's one of the monies in circulation. But this is not the one that acts and fulfills a strategic role because it does not embody the power of capital. Money, specifically capitalistic money, is capital money, the credit money, the debt money. So when you talk about a capitalistic society as if it were a merchant society, no, it's not the same, but because the exchange money or the trade money presupposes and realizes a symmetrical relationship between the producers and the exchangers or traders. Whereas the capital money installs an asymmetric link between exploitation of the difference in class or privative appropriation. Marx used to talk about the exchange money, and you can also see this in the French Revolution's motto, liberty and equality. But capital money, here you have to read domination, exploitation, power of destruction, creation, debt, desire, predation, and theft. And here we stimulate in a very asymmetric manner the functions and roles. The rationality of the trade money or exchange money, which favors soft selling, which evicts violence, is opposed to the irrational rationality of the capital money. And Gilles Deleuze, in fact, defines this in a very exemplary manner. And you can recognize this in contemporary crisis. Money, the capital money, has come to such a point of dementia that in psychiatry, there is only one equivalent. You would talk about a terminal stage. Capital money has reached this terminal stage in the stock exchange system, which seems completely rational. In order to understand it and to learn how it works, the capitalist seems to know what they're doing, and yet it's completely delirious and it's completely demented. The anti-Oedipus written by Deleuze and Guattari talks about the two types of money, the money that you use, you know, the small change to buy a beer, and the money that is, in fact, inscribed in the monetary exchanges of the banks. And there is a difference in power because the exchange money is subordinated to the capital money. So if you confuse them, you make them homogeneous, and you equate them. You equate this to a cosmic swindle, and it's even worse than that. Exchange money, and not taking into account the difference between the two types of money, would actually come down to implementing this swindle yourself. And this is what quite a lot of our scholars are doing right now. Now, the theory of debt in heterodox economy. Here we have to really think again about money and the monetary theory. It really depends on what type of money you're talking about. So let's leave aside the three scholars which have engaged themselves in the dead end and deadlock, and let's turn to the theory of money of the French regulatory school, which introduced quite a number of new ideas compared to standard economy. Here, money is not inferred from the classic political economy and neoclassic notion of barter, merchant economy, but that of debt. So here you have a debt of existence, the original debt, and the life debt. So when you talk about life debt, it's either a priest, a statesman, or a psychoanalyst. So there's no other possibility, really, as soon as you hear someone talk about life debt. Life debt, it means that you recognize that you depend as a living being from a sovereign being, and that you have consented that they have given you part of their cosmic power. So this vital force given that has given life to you as a being means that you are indebted indefinitely. Now, the idea and notion of life debt in Deleuze and Guattari is very different. And it is, in fact, not universal, and it's not at all linked to nature either. It's linked to human nature only. But it's basically the same thing, because the original sin is the same thing. It's something that you have as soon as you are born, and you cannot escape debt because it's part of human nature. So there is a naturalization, so to speak, of this idea of debt. And this is it's the most common conception that you find in various economists and theoreticians, etc., nowadays, the idea of this original debt. But Nietzsche and Deleuze and Guattari have a different notion of debt. So life debt in Deleuze and Guattari and Nietzsche is very different. It does not refer neither to nature nor to the universal. The original debt is not the expression of the link of affiliation of individuals to the community. It is also not the sign of an original debt that is passed on at birth, of a liability, inaugural liability that you cannot redeem. On the contrary, it is produced by a political situation because it is in hierarchical state societies, monotheistic societies that have introduced the debt of existence, the life debt, the primordial debt. And for scholars and the school of regulation, debt in societies, archaic such societies, is a debt which cannot be redeemed. It cannot be paid back. It is inexhaustible. Whereas in capitalism, it's exactly the contrary. Archaic societies were characterized by a finite and mobile debt. At Unstad, so debt becomes an infinite debt. This is a quote by from Anti-Oedipus. the accounting transformation. So in order to cancel debt or transform it, this is, in fact, the endless servicing of debt in the notion of the state. And this is subordinated to all other primitive alliances. And here we have an infinite creditor, an infinite liability replaced by a block of mobile debts. When you introduce the infinite notion of debt in the economy and production system, you extend this debt, it becomes infinite. It becomes an imperial state society, and guilt is also very much present. And in fact, monotheist societies have also intensified this. Financial capitalism has intensified this trend because it has installed finance and money, the credit money, at the heart of accumulative capitalism, in such a way that debt becomes the engine of it. So the cause and the finality of production is to produce more debt or more credit. This is the very definition of the financial capitalism. So you allow for the possibility of paying back your debt, but only in order to take on new loans, new debts. So you can reimburse individual debt, but you cannot pay back all of the debts because we have this fundamental relationship between the debtor and the creditor. You'd have to rearrange all the other types of relationships, the capital work relationship and so forth. Now, allow me to come back to Nietzsche, because Deleuze and Guattari, and for me, there is something fundamental that is said by Nietzsche in his second thought about genealogy of morality and debt. Deleuze is one of the very few philosophers since 1962 which is true to this idea. The fundamental idea is not a trade link, but it's a relationship between debtors and creditors. This is why I actually quoted Deleuze in the very beginning. So Nietzsche, in On Genealogy of Morality, I have to say that this work and Deleuze and Guattari's work have been at the origin of my work on debt. Anthropologists actually have turned their nose up to this second dissertation of Nietzsche because they believe that its content does not match with the content of their own discipline and what they say and think about archaic societies. So let's take, for instance, David Graeber, who wrote a big, thick book on debt. According to David Graeber, Nietzsche seems to accept the premises of Adam Smith, according to which life is exchange. But unlike the latter, this exchange would give the measure of what the world would become like in terms of trading. So according to Adam Smith, or using Adam Smith's theory, Nietzsche would actually not really confirm the theory of original debt, of primordial debt. Equality, in fact, is suspended during the time during which you have to reimburse. But once you have paid back your debt, equality is reestablished. You have this idea of reciprocity, and debt is always considered as being reimbursable. Debt is a relationship which unfolds in the shadow of equality, potentially, and it could always be redeemed. But the other hypothesis, and our hypothesis, is in fact the contrary. Capitalism, especially financial capitalism, debt, is infinite. It's not reimbursable, and it's not atonable. It's not possible to have a political redemption, as Benjamin used to say. And Nietzsche can really help us to unravel this issue, which is so relevant nowadays. Is debt something that can be reimbursable in capitalism? Now, let us focus briefly on some of these concepts. Genealogy of morality, in fact, does not pretend to lay down the foundation for a new anthropology. It is a discussion, an open discussion, about, on the one hand, the idea of free trade. Who cares about the use and who cares about contracts? And on the other hand, you have the theory of value, which would be produced by exchange. So it is a free trade theory that you are producing some value by exchanging. Now, Nietzsche opposes to this the future task of the philosopher. The task of the philosopher would be to solve the problem of value and determine the hierarchy of values. So what is this or that scale of value, and what is behind these values? In order to criticize moral values, you also have to understand the value of these values. And of course, it's a very radical criticism of the English type of or English mode of interpretation of value. Secondly, for Nietzsche, debt does not imply equality and reciprocity, but its contrary. If credit, or if the relationship debt-credit and not exchange constitutes the archetype of social organization, then it's because the powers at play are not equal, but on the contrary, asymmetric. The credit mobilizes active forces and also reactive forces. So debt is, in fact, a place where superior forces meet and fight against inferior forces. And the objective is to construct a subjectivity capable to promise. And so Nietzsche says that we need to build a man that is able to keep his promise. It's fundamental because economy of debt is, in fact, inseparable from the production of subjectivity. It's not economy and then the subject, as in Marxism. Here you have to construct this subject at the same time as you build your economy. So this ability to promise also presupposes the presence of memory for words, and these words that debt will be using in order to make things. So lots of things have been forgotten, and we need to substitute this forgetting by the ability to remember. So the relationship between debtor and creditor is expressed in the activity of training subjectivity. So the economic effect of debt is linked with the production of the culpable man, the indebted man. In fact, we have very comical situations when you're trying to link up debt and guilt. If you read articles on Spain and Greece and Italy, they seem to be saying that you are guilty. Debt is your responsibility. You're not working hard enough. You're just retiring too early and not working long hours. Therefore, you're guilty. But as soon as the news reel finishes, then you have the adverts, and they're saying, no, you're not. You're completely innocent. You're not at all guilty. Yeah, so you have two moralities, the morality of work and debt. That's the guilt morality. And the other morality of consumption, which, of course, is hedonistic by nature. And so now we see that these things that used to match quite well are no longer matching so well. And so this is also part and parcel of the present crisis. Now, let's come back to Nietzsche. Thirdly, the issue of time, as Bergson has said, if it is not creation, then it is nothing at all. And so this is something that you find again in Nietzsche. Exchange, it must be in the instant. If you exchange something, that's it. It's over in a moment. Whereas the nature of debt is to include, to control, exploit time, and also preempt on the future. Debt is a promise of reimbursement. It concerns, therefore, the future. And debt is, in fact, is a capitalistic dispositive in order to enclose and preempt this time. It's not enough to say that debt is a non-finished exchange, because it means nothing, because duration, time, and future represent the very difference between a debt and exchange. For Nietzsche, in fact, to bring up an animal in order for him to be able to promise means that you are able to avail yourself of the future. So you have to be answerable for yourself in advance of what is going to happen in the future. And this is the possibility of creation. So asymmetry is not only between active and reactive forces, but also asymmetry in time, because management and appropriation, expropriation of time, and thereby subjectivity. Fourth idea, Nietzsche indicates clearly the point where debt is finite and reimbursable and becomes unpayable. Life debt, original debt, primordial debt is in fact a production that is relatively that came relatively late and was imposed by the society of constraints. It was in fact the consequence of the rupture of this leap, this constraint, this fatality that we could not avoid. As from this leap, men are accountable, and they are accountable to society, to God, to state, to the active forces, and this finite debt must be tamed in order to act upon the reactive forces. Now, the impossibility to pay back the debt engendered the idea of impossibility to atone, impossibility to redeem debt. As I said earlier, this relationship between creditor and debtor is a relationship between active and reactive forces, management and control of time, as well as infinite debt, which is invested and perpetuated by capital. In financial capitalism, it's impossible to get rid of debt because capital is like money. It's credit, and by definition, it's debt. In fact, money is only some writing. It's a debt by definition. Credit money is, in fact, equal to debt. It's the omega and alpha of the optimization of capital. The reimbursement can never be realized. Otherwise, you would eliminate and extinguish the relationship of capital. The relationship creditor-debtor can never be settled because it constitutes the very relationship of a policy of domination, but also of economic exploitation. So capitalism, contrary to what the scholars believe, capitalism is not based on a system of checks and balances or balance in general. It's not symmetry, it's asymmetry. Crisis actually started in 1973, so we've been in it for many, many years already. And so the disaster is that this crisis is getting deeper and deeper, but I have no time to talk about this. Now, The differential in class is certainly also part of the asymmetry. Credit is the motto of social promotion, and therefore reimbursement is presupposed. But as soon as you have reimbursed, then you have a new loan. So it's not the policy of automatic reimbursement will not free us from this system. I would like to conclude. So contrary to a very widespread opinion, anarchists and neoliberals seem to believe that debt in contemporary capitalism is not reimbursable and payable and finite. I would say that we should not only look at economic categories, but also literary ones such as Franz Kafka, because we are presumed guilty without having committed any mistake, as K in Kafka's book, The Process, The Trial. And so in this work of Kafka, The Trial, you have the notion of acquittal, apparent acquittal. So you move from one debt to the next. You take out a loan, you pay it back, you take out another one. And so it's illimited. It's an endless delaying of the payback of the debt. The credit has not been given in order to be reimbursed, but in order to continuously evolve in an endless variation. It's like the spread. It changes every day, plus or minus. They calculate minimal variations. They have very, very tiny fluctuations on the spreads, and it's always linked to the real time. And this is the situation of the American consumer, but not only sovereign debt is constantly varying. The spread is different between the rate paid by Germany and the other countries. So it's the fluctuation in real time. So the fluctuation and variation of public debt it means that our salaries, revenues, income, services also vary, but usually their value falls, whereas the taxes, etc., are on the rise. Therefore, we can say that reimbursing the debt is very much imposed to European peoples, and it's a political weapon in order to intensify and achieve the neoliberal project, because everyone knows that we cannot quantitatively repay the debt because the sums are too high, and qualitatively it's not possible because financial capitalism doesn't allow for this. This is a continuous variation. In Germany, it was possible only because they actually canceled the debt. So impossibility to reimburse, and therefore we should just simply not pay. Often I'm criticized for being too bleak in my outlook. But I would like to finish with Gilles Deleuze, since I started with him. There is no need for fear, no need for hope. All we need is to find new weapons. Thank you very much.